Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Mike Jeffries, the former boss of the high-end fashion firm Abercrombie & Fitch, along with his partner Matthew Smith and a third man, James Jacobson, were arrested in New York on Tuesday on charges of sexual assault and people trafficking. The offences involved multiple alleged male victims. The indictment was read out by Breon Peace, the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York. And I should warn you that you may find this description disturbing.
The defendants caused the men to believe that not complying with requests for certain acts, sex acts, during the events could harm their careers. The defendants pressured the men to consume alcohol, Viagra, and muscle relaxants known as poppers during the sex events. And they required the presence of staff during the sexual activity and ensured that the men did not leave the sex events until Jeffries and Smith decided that the sessions were over.
Breon Peace. Well, the BBC's Madeleine Holpert was at that news conference, and afterwards she told me more about the charges.
Yeah, so we heard from three prosecutors this afternoon, and they told us about the 16 counts these three men are facing for interstate prostitution and sex trafficking. Prosecutors allege that Jeffries used his wealth as a powerful CEO of the clothing company to create an international sex trafficking and prostitution enterprise. And they say he hired a middleman, Jacobson, to recruit dozens of vulnerable young men hoping for a career in fashion or modeling to travel the U.S. and the world to engage in sex acts with Jeffries and his partner. They said what their investigation uncovered was beyond disturbing, and that Jeffries used prolific amounts of money to arrange these sexual encounters that prosecutors say were also supervised by staff that Jeffries had hired, which made the men feel like they couldn't leave the room during these encounters. Investigators also said they have a ton of evidence to prove their case: travel records, financial records, and other documents.
What role has been played by the BBC investigative series that made some of these allegations first a year ago?
Yeah, prosecutors mentioned today that it was really media reports from 2023 that sparked their investigation into this conduct. They didn't name the BBC, but the BBC was the first to publish an investigation into the alleged sex trafficking. The BBC spoke to 12 men who described attending or organizing these events involving sex acts for Jeffries and his partner. Some told the BBC that they were abused, and others that they had been injected with drugs, things that we heard today during the press conference. And the BBC also identified the middleman who kind of helped facilitate these encounters. So the FBI launched an investigation into the matter shortly after the BBC's reporting.
Have we heard at all from the men's lawyers, for example, about their reaction to being arrested? And do we have a sense of how long it may take before these charges lead to a trial?
So Jeffrey's lawyer told the BBC today that he would respond in detail to the allegations after the indictment was unsealed and when appropriate, but in the courthouse, not through the media. So the three men are expected to appear in court this afternoon, and they'll be arraigned later in New York City, but they haven't yet entered their plea. So we don't know exactly if they'll deny the charges or plead guilty. So we're not really sure of a timeline. If they plead not guilty, then there will be a trial, and that will, of course, be a lengthier kind of timeline.
The BBC's Madeleine Holpert talking to me from New York. Walk along Manhattan's Fifth Avenue, and Abercrombie & Fitch's storefront is as imposing and bland as many of the other buildings on New York's premier shopping street. Although everyone's dollars were welcome when Mike Jeffries, himself preternaturally youthful for one born in 1944, was chief executive, its clothes were modelled by beautiful people, and he made perfectly clear they weren't intended for your average-looking Joe either. But the obsession with youth and beauty curdled in the public minds when a BBC investigation, The Abercrombie Guys, The Dark Side of Cool, was broadcast last year. Madeline was referring to it in the interview a little earlier. Jeffries left the company a decade ago, but only after the BBC aired the allegations did Abercrombie and Fitch stop all payments to him. Charlotte Hardy is editor-in-chief of Retail Week. She told me about Mr. Jeffries' rise and fall at the company and how Abercrombie and Fitch, the brand, has bounced back.
So it's actually a very old brand. It's been around since 1890, something like that. Just straightforward clothing brand, and grew and grew and grew. And then exploded, really, actually, in the late 90s, early noughties. And it became a really, really successful brand under Jeffries. And the reason for that was that kind of sexualized marketing approach. It was like something that people hadn't seen before. And it was really of its moment. I mean, if you remember going into the store, you were greeted by these sort of topless, very good looking male models. The stores were dark. The music was loud. It was a really great store experience. And it resonated, and it was something really sexy and different. And it built a very big brand quite quickly over the time that he was there.
Did it sustain under Mike Jeffries' leadership? Did he manage to keep the kind of commercial success of it going? Because he was sometimes quite, you know, dismissive of some of his customers, wasn't he? He said, models are beautiful because we want beautiful customers. We don't want to be vanilla, was more or less his message.
Unbelievably un-PC, and definitely you wouldn't get away with that now, and very discriminatory against, you know, plus size models. It did do well. It made a lot of noise, and it was quite exclusive, but you can only sustain that for so long. And obviously consumer mindset change as well. And yes, it was doing very well, founded really on this sort of sexualized marketing approach. But there was a certain element of chaos in the background, and, you know, the constant waves of bad PR really that were coming his way in his personal life. You know, there's only so many corporate companies that can survive that.
Why did he go? But was it straightforward? Was it a business decision to get him out as chief executive? What's the understanding of what was going on in the company at the time?
My understanding was that, yes, it was a gradual edging out. But you've got to remember with these big characters that they almost become bigger than the brand. And, you know, the louder you shout, that becomes very difficult to do. And it's no easy feat getting out big names like this sometimes in some companies. So, yes, it was a sort of gradual severance over a long period of time, I suspect, when many of the board were tearing their hair out, I suspect. But consumers don't really care about these kind of scandals. Really, consumers are largely a selfish bunch, if you think about it. And they kind of care about the products that they're buying, and, but, you know, particularly younger consumers buying into a brand that makes them feel part of something. So the idea that I think this has tarnished the brand forever, it just isn't true. The latest results are really, really strong. I mean, it's having an unbelievable success story. I mean, the last quarterly results, you know, its net sales reached $1 billion for the first quarter, you know, this year. The PR will be unwelcome, but I think its target shopper probably won't pay much attention. And that's the sad truth. It will continue to thrive because it's certainly a massive success story at the moment. That's very difficult in the fashion world because it's so competitive.
That's Charlotte Hardy, editor-in-chief of Retail Week on Abercrombie and Fitch, after Mike Jeffries. Last week, France became the first country in the European Union known to have granted temporary entry to 6 deserters from the Russian army. The BBC has since spoken to one of them, Alexander, who served in Ukraine as a volunteer contract soldier before leaving Russia and going to neighbouring Kazakhstan. Alexander now hopes that France will grant him political asylum, where he's likely to remain a target of the Russian security service, the FSB. His replies to our questions were simultaneously translated by a BBC colleague, but we've removed Alexander's voice from the recording for his own safety. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy asked him first how he came to serve in Ukraine.
I was headed for military training. I ended up in Crimea in February 2022. Nobody told us that we were going to Ukraine.
When did it become obvious to you that you were taking part in a full-scale invasion of Ukraine?
As soon as we crossed the Ukrainian border, which was a shock to all the military personnel, I ran up to my command asking, what are we doing here? And he said, just wait 10 days and it'll all be over. I was there against my will. I could not have just dropped my weapons and run towards the Russian border. I would have been shot.
Did you realize that this could be a possibility when you were in Crimea?
in 2022, I was in the process of resigning from the army. I wanted to change my field of work. I didn't want to connect my future life with the military. But we have to understand the defense minister has to relieve me of my duties. All the time that I was in Ukraine, I was looking for a legal way of crossing back into Russia. But then on the 21st of September, they declared partial mobilization. And when that happened, our contracts became open-ended and it was impossible to sever them.
So you fled Russia and you arrived in Kazakhstan. How easy was it to escape?
I could travel there using what's known in Russia as an internal passport. I didn't have a passport that allowed me to travel outside of Russia. I knew that I would be a wanted man in Kazakhstan because there's a treaty between Russia and Kazakhstan on the extradition of criminals. A working group was set up comprising several NGOs such as Russie Liberté, Take a Hike in the Forest, the Kazakh Rights Movement, and together they managed to get in touch with the French government, telling them that we needed help. At that time, Western countries were very afraid that FSB agents would be sent to them posing as Russian deserters. So these NGOs, they established a protocol for verifying us.
How did it feel when you were accepted to come to France on this temporary basis?
I could breathe again. I felt I was a free man again after all that time. I felt that I was a free person, not limited in anything.
But you are a deserter from the Russian army and you know how the Kremlin views you. Do you really feel safe, even in France?
Currently, I feel safer here than I did in Kazakhstan, but I understand that I will not be able to achieve full security. But I have decided to promote the cause of deserters because I think attitudes to these people, they need to change. They've made their choices. They've decided against shedding Ukrainian blood. They know they're facing risks. They know that criminal cases will be launched against them, that their houses will be searched, that their parents will be questioned. They know that they will not be able to come home any time soon. So these people need help.
You said that when you initially were trying to get out into the West, that there was a lot of suspicion, that governments wondered, still wonder, whether people like you pose security risks, could be members of the FSB, could even be war criminals. Do you understand those concerns?
I understand these fears. It took 1.5 years for us to be checked. Within the confines of this verification, this can be a guarantee that they're not FSB agents or that they did not commit war crimes. If these people are not helped, the Kremlin will destroy them.
Former Russian soldier Alexander, not his real name, talking to NewsHour's Jamie Kumarasamy. Coming up, we'll hear from injured Palestinian children finding comfort in music in the middle of the war in Gaza.
We were living a life of bombing and shelling, and I was injured in my leg. When the teacher came, we started practicing on something new, and we learned. When we practice, we can express ourselves and feel relaxed in our hearts.
The BBC headlines here on NewsHour. Ukraine's Prosecutor General has resigned after security services uncovered a massive corruption scheme involving thousands of fake documents which allowed men to avoid conscription. Activists in central Sudan say more than 50 people have been killed in multiple attacks by both the main warring sides in the course of the last week. And Poland is expelling Russian diplomats from its western city of Poznan. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Health officials in Lebanon say the number of people killed by an Israeli airstrike near a hospital in the capital Beirut has risen to 18. Many more were injured. Israel says it was targeting a Hezbollah position. Beirut-based journalist Oliver Marsden works for the Times newspaper. He told me more.
That airstrike happened last night at about 10:30 p.m. Unfortunately, so far, at least 18 people have been killed, including 4 children and dozens more injured. I went to the scene of the strike at about 8 a.m. this morning, and it was just a huge crater in the middle of all these sort of houses, these low-lying sort of little apartment blocks of about 2 or 3 floors high. Rescue workers were digging through the rubble. It was the Lebanese Civil Defense, the Lebanese Red Cross, and included in that was some of the civilian elements of Hezbollah and Amal, paramedics and rescue workers. So there was sort of a joint operation going on. And when we arrived, in fact, one young man had phoned one of his friends, and you could hear the phone ringing under the rubble. And there was this sort of scrabble by the Lebanese Civil Defense, these rescue workers, to try and get to this person under the rubble, but it was still smoking, and it was quite an apocalyptic scene.
And this is an important hospital in Beirut, isn't it?
Well, yes, the Rafiq Hariri Public Hospital is the largest public hospital in Beirut. I mean, the strike itself did actually damage the entrance gate to the hospital. The glass windows in there were all smashed, and even the entrance to the hospital itself, some of the glass doors were damaged and the windows smashed. The hospital is still functioning and still working, luckily, but this is a strike in a residential area, incredibly close to a hospital where I think many people who had already been displaced in the south of Lebanon and other parts of the southern suburbs had moved to this area near the hospital because it felt safe, it felt calmer, it was residential.
Has there been much sense in the last few weeks that people are becoming reluctant to go to hospital?
Yes, I mean, there has been a kind of reluctance to go to hospitals, I mean, reluctance to go to many public institutions. And some of these hospitals are working at full capacity, despite the reluctance, because they're full of people who've been injured. And then other hospitals, like the Sahel Hospital in southern Lebanon, that's not working, completely evacuated because of these claims by the Israeli military that there were tunnels underneath and Hassan Nasrallah had been storing all his gold under there. So there is a reluctance to visit hospitals. And unfortunately, because of the displacement, because of these areas mostly belonging to the Shia community being targeted, there's also a reluctance for people to let other internally displaced citizens and people living in Lebanon into their homes, because it's not only the fear of the hospitals being targeted, people are afraid that their homes will be targeted if they let displaced people from areas that are under attack, if they let them into their home.
That's Oliver Marsden, a journalist for the Times newspaper based in Beirut in Lebanon. Meanwhile, on Monday, Israel said it had identified a bunker with millions of dollars worth of cash and gold, which was underneath another Beirut hospital, the Al-Sahel. Doctors there deny the allegation, and to try to prove their point, today they took the BBC's Ola Guerin on a tour of the building.
We're on level -2 in the Al-Sahel hospital. The area just behind me is where medical waste is stored. Even that was opened up for us to have a look. The morgue was opened up. All of the drawers were opened to show us there was nothing inside.
Ola Guerin at the Al-Sahel Hospital in Beirut. The US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken met Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss the country's operations in Lebanon and in Gaza. He also met the Defence Minister Yoav Gallant. Israeli officials later said that Mr. Blinken had been told it was not their policy to isolate northern Gaza. Just over a week ago, Mr. Blinken and US Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin wrote to the Israeli government with demands for a big improvement in access for humanitarian aid. The BBC, along with other independent journalists, is not allowed into Gaza to report. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has compiled his report from Israel. It begins with Monday's news that at least 10 people have been killed by Israeli artillery fire, which hit a school in the Jabalia refugee camp being used to host people who'd been displaced by the fighting.
Palestinian first responders went to collect bodies in a lull in Israel's offensive in Jabalia and the rest of northern Gaza. The UN says Gaza's nightmare is intensifying. A worsening humanitarian crisis amid what it calls relentless Israeli strikes. This was filmed by a nurse called Nabila. in the moments after an Israeli strike on a UN school in Jabalia used as a shelter by civilians. Close to panic, she tries to tell this woman to be calm, saying, "I have nothing to stop the bleeding." She turns back to help the other casualties. She is the only medic there. Children are dead. A woman's leg has been blown off. And then she runs to get her medical bag. The child says, "Please help. My sister is dying." Nabila hasn't got much. A few basic wound dressings. One of the women says, "My children are gone. Look at them." Back down the stairs, past dead children, and then she screams when she sees the dead body of an elderly man she recognizes. Northern Gaza, just after an airstrike, from a vantage point a few miles away in Israel. It's a public holiday here. This is a popular place to observe the war. Israelis believe the killing and hostage taking by Hamas and the way Palestinians voted for them makes the war in Gaza and the others that followed necessary and just.
If they would return the hostages, then I would have what to feel for them. In the meantime, there's nothing I can feel for them. They've started this, they entered Israel, they attacked us, and all this is the results of their initial actions.
A short drive away, close to the Gaza border, it was a family day out for Israelis who believe the war has given them the chance to recreate a very different Gaza. They want to restore Jewish settlements inside the Gaza Strip that the Israeli government removed in 2005. These people know what they want when eventually there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The Israeli government has only really said what it doesn't want. It doesn't want any kind of governance that looks like progress towards a Palestinian state. Now, that is a problem for its Western allies, the Americans, the British, and others, because they believe a Palestinian state alongside Israel is the only way to stabilize the region and not have perpetual war. Anita Toker brought her family up on a farming settlement in the Gaza Strip. For her, leaving was a gross injustice. I played her a report I did about her departure 19 years ago.
This is an integral part of the state of Israel.
Since that day in 2005, they've dreamt about a return. And now they see Palestinians forced out of large areas of Gaza and are pushing to replace them.
I think we have an opportunity to build much more than we had before. I think we should build cities in some of the places. We should bring many, many more of Israel's population into the Gaza Strip. I think those people in the Gaza Strip, and there are a lot, that want to leave. Why is Egypt and Israel not allowing them to leave and go to Europe?
The bomb shelters where Israelis fled from Hamas have been made into memorials to the dead and to the hostages. This is where many were cornered and killed. The war is changing the Middle East in ways no one fully understands yet, and it's widening and escalating.
The BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bone, on how the war has changed Gaza and how it may yet change again.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Mozambique in East Africa is on the front line of the climate crisis, with intense tropical storms pounding it on a regular basis. The destruction caused by these storms is made worse because extensive logging has led to deforestation. Now, a Gulf-based company, Blue Forest, says it has secured a contract to plant 200 million trees. As Joe Tembe now reports, the Mozambique government says this will be the start of a much-needed regeneration.
This is the sound of strong winds blowing from the Indian Ocean onto Mozambique's coast. The country's 2,500-kilometre coastline is home to an extensive mangrove ecosystem, but in recent years it has been devastated by the twin effects of violent storms and deforestation. The loss of the mangroves is considered so worrying in Mozambique that even local musicians have joined the fight to save them. Musician Rosalia Mboa sings Preservação do Mangal, Preserve the Mangroves.
I wrote this song because I observed the devastation of mangroves and I'm asking people to stop.
To help improve the situation, the Mozambican government has awarded a license to the Gulf-based company Blue Forest. The company's founder and chief executive officer is Vaid Fotuli.
The core objective is to first restore the areas, which add up to about 30,000 hectares of degraded mangroves. And secondly, to conserve. We understand it's very important to engage with the communities and have them feel a sense of ownership of the project.
Mozambican ecologist Carla Mohamani says that projects like this are essential not only to protect the coastline, but also the livelihoods of the people who live there.
Having a protected, well-maintained mangrove ecosystem means we'll have a rich diversity of trees and plants, as well as marine and river-dwelling creatures. This will benefit us economically, socially, and environmentally. We'll be healthier because the mangrove trees will absorb carbon dioxide. At the same time, the mangroves will act as a nursery for both marine and bird species.
According to Mozambique's National Director of Climate Change, this is the first of many projects. The government hopes will not only restore the mangroves, but help coastal communities survive. As Rosalia Mboa sings, preserving the mangroves is vital for both the wildlife and the people of Mozambique. The hope is that projects like this one will turn the tide against the loss of habitat and ensure future generations will thrive despite the changing climate on Mozambique's coast.
That's Joe Tembe on restoring the mangroves to Mozambique. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. Now, one of the men alleged to have played a significant role in promoting Russia in the referendum at the weekend is a man called Ilan Shaw. We're going to hear about him in a moment. But first, let's hear from our correspondent in Eastern Europe, Sarah Rainsford, who covered that referendum on whether or not Moldova should join the EU and have that recognised in its constitution. One of the many concerns the US and many European nations have had with Moscow is over alleged interference in elections like the one that took place in Moldova at the weekend, along with the referendum. And we reported on NewsHour on Monday that that referendum was only won narrowly, with Moldova's president complaining that foreign agents had tried to meddle in the vote. The allegation is that Russia interfered with the campaign and then with the vote to turn this small former Soviet state bordering Ukraine away from the European Union and forge closer ties with Moscow. How credible are those allegations? Here's our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, who saw the voting take place.
At polling stations in Moldova, they were keeping it cheerful as the country voted not just for a president, but a political direction in a referendum that was supposed to turn Moldova definitively away from Russia and towards the West. The decision was on including EU membership in the constitution. Maia Sandu is the president who called that vote, and she's now calling what happened next a vile attack on democracy, led from abroad. Because police here say they've uncovered a scheme to channel millions of dollars from Moscow to Moldova to pay for votes against Sandu and against the EU.
This was the EU referendum. This was a very close vote. You nearly lost it.
She only won the referendum by just over 13,000 votes. And the presidential elections will go to a second round. Maya Sandu told me other countries should take note.
What's not normal is to have a situation where criminal groups are bribing voters. Once these practices have been tried here, they might be tried in other countries. And we need to take seriously our democracies, and we need to learn from each other how to defend our democracies.
Are you blaming Russia directly? You talk about criminal groups and foreign
I'm blaming forces. The criminal groups who are using the dirty money to buy the Moldovan votes.
Here's a question.
It wasn't hard to find proof of that. At this polling station in a high school, my colleague saw a woman drop her ballot into the plastic box, then turn to an election monitor and ask where she could get paid. So outside, I asked her how much cash she was getting. 1,000 rubles, she told me, straight out. She wouldn't share who she'd been told to vote for, but she did say there were five people just in her group who'd all been bribed. She was only angry that the man who'd offered her money then disappeared. We were in the southeast, close to the border with Transnistria. That's the sliver of land that broke away from Moldova when the USSR fell apart. There are still Russian troops there. If they cross the border, Transnistrians still get to vote in national elections, and we found lots of them at the bus stop. I expected people to be staunch supporters of Russia, and some of them were. But there were plenty like Lera, a pensioner who told me clearly she was voting for the EU. She said she was fed up of being poor and just wanted to live like a normal person, like they do in Europe. So, as Moldova mulls over what's happened, it does seem entirely possible that the voting here was just as dirty as Maia Sandu has set out. In the end, a majority did choose the EU, but only just. And everything we saw suggests that Moscow isn't done here.
Sarah Raines reporting from Moldova's capital, Chisinau. And what of Ilan Shaw, the man I mentioned earlier? Well, he's a billionaire who was convicted in Moldova of money laundering and embezzlement. In the run-up to last Sunday's EU referendum and presidential election, he was accused of being at the centre of this pro-Russian vote-buying and vote-influencing scheme. He spoke to NewsHour's Tim Franks from Moscow, where he now lives. What's his response to the allegations?
First, it's full liar position of government. Why? First of all, government take money from government, from the state, and they do full promotion of European Union on money from the taxes. This is the first. Second, the organization like Konrad Adenauer Foundation, like Soros Foundation, they put a lot of money on this campaign and for the promotion of European Union. Third issue. Yes, my position fully understand from my side and from my people that we not support join European Union by Moldova. Second, that a lot of party who is agree with my position, government don't allow them to be participating in this referendum by the law and to tell their position to the people. Second issue, yes, I am the member of Eurasia Organization Foundation. It's something the same like Soros Foundation, like Konrad Adenauer, we do a lot of same job. Yes, it's true. We take people for the job. We have a full contract with them, contract by the law. We give to people money for paid taxes from this money what they received from us. The contract is about that they do promotion of our position. Their job is to tell people, to explain them why we are fully against European Union, why we need to do this. Because for last year, government closed 15 oppositional channels in Republic of Moldova. Today, if you will open your TV in Moldova, you can see only pro-government TV station. That's all. You have only one position. It's not normal. It's not democratic. For the last 2 weeks was more than 140 raids searched by police in last 2 weeks before the election. And also not democratic, because all what they do in Moldova fully total regime. It's really regime.
It's one thing to fund a campaign from abroad, and you're saying, look, the people who were in favour of joining the European Union, they got money from outside lobby groups as well. But the investigations that have been done into your network have shown that people have been paid to come on demonstrations, on protests, and far more seriously, that people have been given money to vote in a certain way. That is something different, isn't it?
Okay, I explain you. First, we never give money people to vote for us, and we never give people... First, what you say, sorry, for vote, and first you say...
For protests, so people were being
for
paid...
We never give money. The question that no one normal people in Moldova not believe to prosecutor office of Moldova and to police, because they are fully under the government, and they are not independent. They are fully not independent. It was a lot of examples when prosecutor office and police do all against the law. That's why we not believe, not prosecutor office, not police today, unfortunately.
You say people don't believe the prosecutor's office. I mean, why should people, to be blunt, believe you, given that you have a conviction for an absolutely massive banking fraud?
I explain you. In this conviction, nobody also not believe. You see what result I have in Moldova and how people believe me. Not no one believe in this conviction, because all people know that this is a political prosecution.
You talked about your support for Alexander Stoyanoglo, the man who came second in the presidential election. He now goes into a runoff with the current president, who is the pro-European Union candidate. Mr. Stoyanoglo, from what I understand, he has said that he is in agreement with the idea of joining the European Union in principle for Moldova. So can you explain to me why you think he is the right man, given that you're so against the European Union?
I don't tell that I support Alexander Stoyanoglo first. I even don't say my position in second tour. Why? Because I need to speak with my team, with my people. We will do this in a few days. We will discuss our position in second tour. Yes, we against position of European Union, and we will think what to do. It will be our target to understand our position in second tour in a few days.
But, right? I mean, presumably you don't want President Sandu to get back in.
I don't want President Sandu at all, yes, in principle. But what we will do in second tour, we will think, because we have other option also.
Right. I mean, you're saying this all from... I mean, you're currently in Moscow, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Moscow.
I mean, does it sound right to you that you're talking about how you can influence... I mean, so openly talking about how you can influence the next vote inside Moldova. You don't hear people in other foreign capitals talking about, you know, what they can do to change the result of an election in another country in such an open way.
Of course, as they speak, Mr. Macron give fully support to Maya Sandu and help her with money from budget to France. Von der Leyen was in Moldova and speak stupid things that she will give 3 billion euro to Moldova, what has never happened, and she knows this, to support Maya Sandu. From Washington, a lot of people support Maya Sandu openly and give money. We understand each other. But the problem is that money from me, it's black money, but the money from them, it's white money. It's because today we have such world. when all what is go from European Union in the United States is good, all what go from Russia is bad.
And it's just to be clear, you say all that comes from Russia. Is this money your money, or is it money that you are being given to spend?
It's my money. It's my money. It's money of people who do donation in Eurasia organization. Yes, I have money, and it's not big secret.
Do you have any contacts with the Kremlin?
No. Of course, no. I'm a person who is do business here, and I live here. Here live my family. I do Moldavian politics, and of course, I have no official contacts about Moldova.
Right, no official contacts. Unofficial contacts?
All we have different friends. It's normal. It's our life.
That's the Moldovan billionaire Ilon Shaw talking to Tim Franks here on NewsHour. And just to say that the runoff election between Maia Sandu and Alexandra Stoyanoglu is on the 3rd of November. That's a week Sunday in Moldova. That'll be the second round because Maia Sandu, although she finished ahead, did not win enough votes to secure re-election as president of Moldova. So the runoff takes place in just under 2 weeks' time. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Stay with us. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. He's Kamala Harris's not-so-secret weapon, the 44th President of the United States. Barack Obama is back on the campaign trail. Later today, he'll be in one of those swing states we're talking a lot about right now, in this case, Michigan. Mr. Obama is seen by many in the Democratic Party as the one politician capable of persuading African-American men not to vote for Donald Trump. Time's critical. Polling day is exactly a fortnight away. Quinn Kleinfelter from Detroit Public Radio takes up the story.
Well, he's here to endorse Kamala Harris, as he did during the Democratic convention and as he has done throughout the time since. But he's particularly targeting a couple of voting blocks, especially suburban voters. And in Obama's case, black men in particular. There's a massively large African-American population in the city of Detroit. And it's one that the Harris campaign vitally needs to have turnout in order for her to have a good shot of winning in the battleground state of Michigan. I talked to a guy who runs his own cleaning business, a small business named Delano Shorter. And he had said that even though there's data showing that the economy is improving, he's not feeling that in his real personal life.
With inflation getting so high, out of control, even after they say that it's going down, it's not. These prices continue every year, go up more and more. And with it being more expensive, I have to charge my clients more because of inflation of my products that I have to use.
That's the least of my worry. Woman brought everyone into this world. So that's one of the hardest things to do, for a woman to give birth and put you in this world. So you mean tell me a woman can't run the country?
That's a guy from Detroit named Rashard Smith, and he's actually bringing up the other issue that Obama's expected to address, which is among some people, particularly, it seems, some young black males, they have a bit of concern about whether any woman would be able to serve as president. They'd had some issues arise along those lines when Hillary Clinton was running a number of years ago. And again, it's been something that's come up among some people anyways, when they discuss Kamala Harris's campaign.
This has been an unusually short presidential campaign for Kamala Harris since she only became the candidate in the summer. How is Obama being used by the campaign?
Well, as you say, it's a compressed quest for Harris to try to reach the White House. And they are using him as perhaps the biggest draw in the Democratic Party. He's very popular throughout the entire United States, at least on the Democrat side. He makes the case very well for why they should try to avoid Donald Trump. And what Obama will argue is his inability to actually grasp the facts of what the country would be dealing with. Perhaps the only more popular person than Barack Obama is his wife, the former First Lady, Michelle Obama. And she will actually be in Detroit as well this coming weekend. It will be the first time that she and Harris have campaigned together since the Democratic National Convention in August.
Now, there's another voting community which could cause some problems for Kamala Harris. Indeed, it was causing problems for Joe Biden because of what was happening in Gaza, and that's Arab Americans. How significant a group are they in Michigan?
They are a significant population, and as you say, that has been a concern for the Harris and the Biden administrations. They want to continue to support Israel. At the same time, the Arab Americans that are here, there's a fair amount of them who have relatives that are in Lebanon or that are Iraqis, and a number who are Palestinians. In fact, the only Palestinian American that's in Congress is from the Detroit area. And even people that are not Arab will say, they look at this and say that it's akin to a genocide, that tens of thousands of civilians being mowed down in Gaza, and that there needs to be a ceasefire. And the problem, I think, for the campaign now is that it is such a tight race in all the battleground states, but especially in Michigan, where it just is just a few thousand votes that could actually tell the difference. That amount of people staying home could possibly push the election to the side of Donald Trump.
That's Quinn Kleinfelter of Detroit Public Radio talking to me earlier. For the last year, schools in Gaza have either been shut, damaged or destroyed, or else converted into shelters for the dispossessed. The Edward Said Conservatory for Music is trying to keep children playing despite the restrictions imposed by war and the injuries sustained by some of its young musicians. The BBC's former Gaza correspondent John Donison reports.
In Gaza, amidst the mayhem, a moment of melody. For children, learning music is not easy at the best of times. And for Mohammed, playing the violin, these are the worst. The 14-year-old lost part of his arm in an Israeli airstrike.
It changes the atmosphere of the war, from what has happened to me and from what is happening. It changes the mood when I play the violin.
He and his teacher, Sama, have to improvise, carefully tying the violin bow to his elbow with a scarf.
He is a child who used to play the oud before he lost his hand during the school bombing. I wanted Muhammad to continue his dreams by teaching him music and helping him achieve what he couldn't before. I decided to teach him how to play the violin because it was difficult for him to play the oud.
And that's the instrument, like a Middle Eastern lute, that 10-year-old Abed al-Rahman is learning. He had to have part of his leg amputated.
We were living a life of bombing and shelling, and I was injured in my leg. When the teacher came, we started practicing on something new, and we learned. When we practice, we can express ourselves and feel relaxed in our hearts.
His teacher is 15-year-old Salah.
The children are very happy to experience something new, like musical instruments. They are excited and keep asking us to come every day.
Both Salah and Sama were students at the internationally renowned Edward Said Conservatory for Music in Gaza City, but it was bombed earlier in the war. Over the last few months, they've been teaching in three schools now turned into shelters for displaced children and their families. One of them is 11-year-old Lina.
It's a beautiful feeling because when the teachers come, they help us escape the state of the war we're living in.
After a year of war for these traumatised children, music offers a rare chance to let their hearts sing.
The young musicians at the Edward Said Conservatory for Music determined to play on. Thanks for joining me on NewsHour.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somasganda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election? And how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.